pint, like sort of like a notch filter. Not really a notch filter, but I guess a notch filter. That's the only time I've ever seen a coil like that in a circuit, and I'm trying to remember what the heck the thing was, so I can pass that along, but I can't remember. It was a while ago. N2YJC, Dick.
Interesting, Lou. When you do find out what that was, that would be nice to know. When it comes to unusual inductive circuits like this, Glenn has done things like this. We're going to go over to Glenn. Then I'm going to go back to Mike because I've got a question for Mike. But Glenn first. KC2QIQ. Go right ahead, Glenn. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. I also want to say hi to Mike Cosma. It's been quite a few years since I've actually worked with Mike, but let me say hi again. But actually, the type of circuit that you're describing here with the with two coils and basically bucking the inductance by taking one inductor and then a similar inductor of the same number of turns, the kind of problem that you run into here is the coupling coefficient. The inductance, if the coupling coefficient was 1, in other words, the two windings were completely well coupled, independent of frequency, the inductance would completely cancel when it's in the bucking position. But unfortunately, there's going to be some mismatch in that coupling. It's not going to be 1. It's going to be something less than 1. And what will happen, as that coupling coefficient gets further and further away from 1, there's going to be leakage inductance between the two windings. So what actually you're measuring the differences is because a inductor wound with a very, very low inductance in air, measured at, like, say, between 1 kilohertz to 100 kilohertz on a typical impedance bridge, isn't going to be very large in the first place. Then when you take that another coil, closely coupled but not completely coupled, you're not going to get the full advantage of completely canceling the inductance because of the coupling coefficient. KC2QIQ, back over to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, Glenn brought up a very interesting point here. The coupling coefficient between the red and the green winding on the second toroid. If it was wound on a high-quality ferromagnetic material, the coupling coefficient in a toroidal manner can be made very, very tight, very close to unity. When you do it in air, the coupling coefficient is much more difficult to achieve because of the way air behaves. You get all kinds of leakage reactances around each individual turn of the inductor. And some of the flux of turn number 1 might not link turn number 2, so to speak. When I say turn number 1 and turn number 2, I'm talking about the first and second turn of the red wire itself. I'm not even flipping between the wires. So when the flux doesn't in air link all those turns, the estimation becomes much more difficult. Another thing worth considering here is that when you're measuring what you think is inductive reactance, and you've got as much ohms as 6 ohms, depending on how you use the instrumentation, you may be measuring total impedance, resistance plus reactive, which is square root of 1 over R squared plus X squared, so you may be measuring total reactance, or total impedance, and maybe not completely separating out the inductive component from the resistive component. So the way a person sets up the instrumentation and the way he interprets the results can give more complication to what's going on. Mike, from what you're hearing so far, how useful do you think this circuit is? And particularly as you approach resonance, I think you've already indicated that some pretty wild things can take place. WY2U, A2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, okay, Dick. WY2U. Yeah, it sounds like this is some kind of a common mode filter. But I'm not convinced it's frequency, or I'm not so sure it wants to be frequency selected, but it might be. And you bring up a very good point, too. It would be wise for the gentleman who did the measurement to ascertain that he is hopefully just measuring the inductive reactance component and not the total impedance component, because that would give you obviously erroneous results. It almost sounds like this is an audio application, because it sounds like there's a lot of turns, number 30 wire. The total resistance is about 6 ohms. By the way, that's about 650 feet of wire, I think, and 3 inches in diameter. That's, you know, several tens of turns. It sounds like this would be an audio application. The other gentleman who said he saw something similar to this at 5 kilohertz, I think he's right on the money. But it sounds like it's a common mode type of filter, probably to suppress either pickup or noise, perhaps at audio frequencies, Dick, and I think that's what's going on here. Back to Ned, WITU.
Thank you, Lou. And Lou, you got to sign in a little more often. I think you're out there occasionally listening, and I think this is one of the first times we've heard from you in quite a long period of time. As I said, welcome back and come back a little more often. So, Wesley, N2XJ, and Wesley is the man who asked the original pretty deep, puzzling question here tonight, and that is, Wesley, do you believe this might be an audio amplification? And hopefully when you go back to your friend and ask him to sweep the frequency and redo the measurements, he's going to be able to plot a curve, and we can find out, is toroid number one and toroid number two behaving in a linear manner? That would imply that non-resonance is taking place, or a non-linear manner, implying that resonance could certainly be taking place. And also, are you relatively sure he is separately measuring the inductive reactance from the from the resistance, and not just measuring overall impedance? And Mike brought up another very good point. 6 ohms of wire at 30 gauge implies 600 feet of wire, and with a 3-inch diameter coil, that's a lot of turns. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for the beep.
N2YJC, I just remembered.
Yeah, we'll come back to you, Lou. Wesley first. Wesley, wait a second or so beyond the beep, please.
Okay. Well, the application is 50-60 hertz, and it is not audio. As you know, I'm working on certain devices, as I mentioned many times, and I actually put myself into the position of cooperating with a number of people, and I believe the person that I was describing is absolutely great with electronics. I would compare him with Glenn, and he said to me, I don't understand that. So it's 50-60 hertz application. It's back to you, Dick, and you give the microphone to.
Very interesting. Okay. And I think this might be involving some of the rotary machines that, or at least rotary-like machines that you've been telling us about.
No moving parts.
No moving parts. Okay, very good. Lou, and to YJC, where do you remember seeing a circuit like that, Lou?
It was N2YJC. It was in a high-powered audio amplifier where the power supply for the audio amplifier had a I guess had a glitch in it where it was creating noise at roughly 5 kilohertz, and that's where I saw this coil being used. And what I forgot to mention earlier, it was a tunable slug type coil. It had quite heavy wire, because I believe the coil was in series with the power supply feeding the amplifier. This was a 500 watt audio amplifier that was actually being used to generate a 50 cycle sine wave on its output. But that's a whole nother story. We were using that to create 50 cycle 110 volts with a step up transformer. But that's again a completely different story. But the that coil was tunable to get rid of that that component in the power supply. And I thought it was very strange, because it really had no inductance, but there was something funny going on, and I really didn't understand it. But you tuned the slug on that coil, and you completely got rid of that noise from the power supply. Go ahead.
Okay, that's what you said. Something very strange was going on. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Lou, when you were building that 500 watt power supply, generating 50 hertz, 120 volt sine wave, and you wanted to get rid of a 5 kilohertz glitch, does that mean that the power supply was being fed with a switching regulator of some kind that had a 5 kilohertz component, And so this unusual winding was used to kill that 5 kilohertz component. Is that approximately what was going on from your recollection, Lou? N2YJC, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Yes, I believe so. We had a 50 hertz sine wave generator going onto the input of this audio amplifier, and the output of the audio amplifier was fed into a step-up transformer, and there was a feedback circuit to adjust the gain to keep the voltage at 100, and actually it was 100 volts. We were building some equipment for, I believe it was Japan, that runs 100 volts, 50 cycles, and we needed a real clean sine wave, 100 volt source. But yes, and when the if that choke wasn't adjusted properly, the audio amplifier got very upset and went into some sort of oscillation. So the instructions with this thing said that, you know, depending on temperature and what have you, you may need to adjust this this choke, which seemed like a very narrow notch filter. And when I looked at the schematic, you know, I sort of tilted my head and said, that doesn't make sense. So anyway, that's what I remember about this whole subject, Dick. Back to that N2YJC.
Okay, Dick, one more thing.
Now let me ask Mike a question on this one. Assuming that there was a 5 kilohertz spurious output of some form from a switching regulator, and assuming now that this coil would be, if it's wound with big enough wire, would be low enough in resistance so that you're not losing much power resistively, but you want to suck out 5 kilohertz, and you've got a tunable magnetic slug, and therefore you make the system hit some form of resonance at 5 kilohertz to give you a notch filter. Have you ever seen anything like that in your experience, Mike? WY2U, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized, but Mike first. Wait for the beep.
No, I can't say that I have, Dick. First of all, the 6 ohms of resistance would preclude the possibility of this being a high power application. You just have too much drop across the 6 ohms. So I really can't say that I've ever seen it done in the way you're describing. I can see how it would work. It's not really going to be a I guess it's going to be a pole, right? A series trap. I guess you can call it a notch filter, although in the usual sense of the word, a notch filter is going to bypass something to ground. In this particular case, it's acting like a big parallel resonant circuit in series with a feed. So I guess you could still call that some kind of a notch filter, but I would call that a pole rather than a zero. But again, the 6 ohms bothers me because that would definitely not be a high power application. Back to net.
Comment?
Yeah, there's two things going on here, Mike. One, Wesley is describing a particular experiment and coil, and Lou is describing a real high-power amplifier that was wound with heavy-gauge wire where there was no 6 ohms. But he did have a counter-wound inductor. That inductor was tunable. He wanted to get rid of a 5KC component on this switching regulated power supply that was feeding a high-power 500-watt, 50-hertz sine wave generator. So we're mixing two things together there. So it does look to me like it's got the capability. The next person who signed in was Glenn. And after that, we'll pick up comment, and then we'll go back to Wesley one more time. KC2QIQ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
And I knew, is that an idea?
And Alex also on the list. Go ahead there, Glenn.
Yeah, very good, Dick. This is actually a very, very poor man's EMI filter, but sometimes what will happen is if you have a limited number of stages in an input EMI filter, where you have a common mode inductor, and typically there's a Y-cap going from each side down to chassis someplace. And basically what's happening is you've got very, very high inductance from either side with respect to the line, or the neutral with respect to the ground. Now, what'll happen is if you have multiple stages and multiple Y-caps, you can create multiple poles, like Mike Cosmo was just mentioning before. So you'll have a group of poles, and you can get a lot of attenuation over quite a bandwidth. It's a very, very good cutoff. Now, the problem is if you're stuck with one stage, sometimes what will happen in a very, very cheap and dirty way of doing things, you can create a tunable inductor, common mode coupling, where you can create a high Q point with the Y capacitor, and basically what's happening is you've got the common mode rejection, and then basically you're tuning it for basically a pole, which gives you the highest attenuation point on that curve just at the point that you need it, because sometimes your filter has a little bit of gain before it starts the roll-up, and then at the bottom you have a small amount of overshoot before it comes back down to its platform. So sometimes by adjusting that, you can actually give yourself a little bit more attenuation by doing a fine-tune. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
For those who are tuning in late, what you're hearing is a discussion of an unusual way of winding what ordinarily would be called a series filter choke on a power supply. As part of what Lou has brought to our attention, Mike has been addressing, not necessarily exactly the experiment that Wesley has described to us. Right now we've got a person who said comment, and then we've got Alex, and then back to Wesley in that order. Who's the person who said comment? Please give me your call letters and name, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Yeah, okay, Dick, it was Lou, N2YJC. You took the words out of my mouth. Mike was getting confused over the 600 ohms in Alex's case versus what I had suggested, so I just was going to jump in there and clear that up. At any rate, back to that. And by the way, Mike, it's been a long, long time. WY2U, how are you? N2YJC, back to net.
Yeah, welcome back, Mike, to old homework. Okay, Alex wanted to make a comment. N2NNU, go right ahead. The RF voice of Yonkers. You got it, Alex.
Good evening, one and all. I think I'm seeing here something that is called a magnetic compensation circuit, which is usually used in trying to cut off the saturation core of a magnetic circuit by reversing the voltage on it, and thus creating a reverse magnetic field that will kill the hysteresis, thus speeding up the recovery of the coil, of the magnetic core. That's what I see in it. Perhaps Glenn, encountered a magnetic compensation circuit, might have some words about it. Back to you, Dick.
Very interesting. What Alex is bringing to our attention is that when you use an inductor as part of a power supply, because you want the inductor to have series inductance to get rid of ripple, to make the power supply more pure in output, you run into a conflict, a compromise. As you wind more turns on the core of the inductor material, the good news is that the inductance that you measure, if you naively measure it on some kind of a LCR meter, you will measure more and more inductance, and you'll think, gee, everything's good. Well, if you're making, let me pick a number, a 10 ampere power supply, and you put 10 amperes through that beautiful inductor you've just wound, quite possibly you have created a total magnetic field into that core that saturates the core. When the magnetic field in the core hits the maximum, the saturation, let me drop. All of a sudden, the inductance goes down to a much lower number. So the compromise is that if I wind more turns, I get more inductance, but I have more saturation, and the saturation makes the inductance almost disappear, or at least go to very low numbers. Manufacturers of series inductors intended for power supplies try to get around this problem by various techniques. One of them is not to wind as many turns and sacrifice the total amount of inductance they could make. Another one is they put an air gap somewhere in the coil, in the core, so that the magnetic flux is not as easily built up. It's running into an air gap, which magnetically has a lot of magnetic resistance, you could call it. Reluctant, you know what I mean. But by putting a gap in the core, that's one of the techniques. Now, with this technique of where you've got a tunable inductive slug, which you can move into the coil and run into resonance at the particular frequency of your ripple. Maybe it's the ripple from a switching power supply or the full wave ripple from your three-phase full wave rectifying network. You can tune out specific frequencies. And there's a whole art and science, and the way you make that slug so that you get the resonance without getting tight coupling between the coils. So it's a way of building a notch filter for a particular ripple frequency. Lots and lots of fancy techniques can be done with power supplies, humbucking networks and whatever. Modern-day supplies, let me drop. Modern-day supplies try to do an awful lot of this electronically. In the old days, you really chose great big capacitors, great big inductors in order to make a clean power supply. With electronic regulation circuits, you could now look at the ripple coming out of your power supply, feed that signal back in an inverse manner to your series coupling transistor if you're using one, and that's one of many ways in which you can now make electronically, you can emulate many farads of capacitance or many henries of inductance. In reality, neither one is there. You're just putting an exotic control circuit, control signal into a pass transistor, a shunt transistor, buck boost power supply, switching regulators. There's all kinds of fancy things you can do these days. So would you still do it magnetically? I'm a little bit skeptical of that, but still a darn interesting experiment. And back to you one more time, Wesley, because we got to move on to the next person. N2XJN, fascinating question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, for me, it's also fascinating. I'm kind of consumed by that. N2XJN. Well, what then is going to be happening is, let's say, instead of alternated current, you put a steady current in that particular bipolar kind of coil, and you just pulse that. It means interrupt whatever the voltage that you have on it. There is no capacitor. There is just a coil. What is then going to come out of that coil? Is that going to be nothing if you put any kind of receiver or meter or anything just to measure if it's anything that is coming out of that whole coil? Back to you, Dick.
The best I can think of building this in the way that was described by Lou, where he had a tunable slug in a bucking kind of a filter choke in his high-power power supply for his 500-watt, 50-hertz sine wave generator. He was trying to tune out a particular frequency. So every real circuit has a certain amount of reactance, a certain amount of resistance, for each individual frequency you feed into that network. What you're describing is a much more complicated network than normally is used. I mean, the schematic diagram on the page would just show some turns clockwise and turns counterclockwise, so to speak. There's a lot more going on there. So with careful choice of the core, this bucking arrangement would have a inductor that has much less saturation characteristics. That's the good news, but I think you could tune it to tune out, you could adjust it to tune a particular frequency to act as a high reactance in a series manner, and that's what I think is going on here. It's one of the possible applications. Guaranteed there are others. I think we're going to move on now, and at the time left over at the end, we'll come back to this one. The next person who signed in, let me drop, was Skyler. KC2WIP, I had some conversations with Skyler during the week, and Skyler has gone out and built a homebrew 2-meter ground plane antenna, the kind that some of us have seen in various articles, or we've actually built one, with an SO239 connector, various ways of mounting it, and you put approximately 19-inch pieces of wire in the four corners for the ground plane radials, and another piece of wire at the center for the actual radiator. To homebrew antennas is a real fun thing to do in ham radio. It's where we can get a lot of bang for the dollar and learn an awful lot about how antennas work and not necessarily spend a whole lot of money. And this particular antenna doesn't cost very much, and so building more than one of them, possibly putting it outdoors and not worrying about weatherproofing or weatherproofing it, and there's various ways of making it mechanically stronger. It's an extremely good basic 2-meter antenna to start off with, and then the coat hanger Yagi type antennas are another real fun thing to experiment with. Let's see what Skyler's doing. Skyler, for those who may not know, he's got his license rather recently, got his rig rather recently, and he's trying to learn an awful lot of things at once. I know a little bit about what he's going through. In the beginning, it seems like there's a zillion things to learn, and if you're a little bit frustrated by that, Skyler, you're in good company, not to worry. KC2WYP, make sure you wait for the beep, and then 1 or 2 seconds, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, KC2 with Yankee Papa. Well, I was actually just having a conversation with, I guess it was Bernie on Echolink, and, you know, I was having some trouble with that, but he explained that to me rather well. But my question for you tonight was, you know, I guess it was the last TechNet, or maybe even after that, when I was talking about the antenna, you were talking about an RF choke. And in Radio Shack, when I was picking up the connector, I saw I'm not even sure what it says, 100 microhenries RF choke. And I was wondering if I could use that. It was only $1.39, so I picked that up. And I was wondering if that would be of any use. And if so, how do I install it? Over to you, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Okay. 100 microhenries at 144 megacycles. I'm doing the 915, 146. The ratio between those two is that. And you're going to get around 92 ohms. So 100, well, that's 100 microhenries, not 100 nanohenries. Woohoo! 100 microhenries. Therefore, at 91 kilo ohms. You probably know the formula. Let me drop it. The formula for inductive reactants is X of L. That's the symbol they use for inductive reactants. X stands for reactants, and the sub L means the inductive reactants, is 2 pi FL. 2 pi is 6.28 times frequency in hertz and inductance in henries. 2 pi FL. You got to make sure the units are right. You do that, and I think 100 microhenries at 146 megacycles comes out something like 91 kilo ohms. Lots and lots of inductance. Anything that's high in inductive reactance compared to 50 ohms, your cable going into the antenna is 50 ohms, and it'd like to not disturb that 50 ohms of resistance. It'd like the inductance to be a large number compared to it, and 500 would be more than enough. 91 kilo ohms, if I did the mathematics correctly, is way beyond what you need, but not bad. And the price was right, and so the whole reason that we talked about that inductor, let me drop, that RF choke, is to be double darn sure that you don't have any electrostatic pickup on the antenna. Some people will put a RF choke from the center conductor of your antenna to the outer conductor, so to speak, to the ground planes. And that way, static charge is going to be drained off by that RF choke. Other people think that a 500 kilo ohm, half watt resistor would do the job equally as well. Some rigs have a capacitive coupling network on the input of the actual receiver. As such, that is a DC open circuit. Very few rigs nowadays, I think, are going to take the risk of doing that. But if they did, the wind blowing past the antenna on a dry day could build up a charge. The charge eventually exceeds the voltage breakdown of that series capacitor in the receiver, and all of a sudden your radio gets zapped and maybe it damages the front-end transistor. Modern-day rigs that you and I can buy, almost none of them have that vulnerability. The need for the RF choke is belt and suspenders, if you know what I mean. I think it's not really required. So I think you now know a little bit about why we suggested either a resistor or an RF choke. I'm not sure you really got to do it, but if you want to, it's another good experiment. And it would be kind of fun to measure the standing wave ratio of your antenna before and after you add that RF choke. And if the RF choke is properly installed, doing its job correctly, it should have almost no impact on the performance of the antenna. And it's going to take a while for all this. We're feeding you 40 pieces of information all at once, Skyler. I've got some idea of what it's like. And at first you're going to say, my goodness, do I have to know all of this? KC2WYP. K2RIW in the TechNet. Now wait for the beep.
Okay, KC2, Whiskey Yankee Papa. Yeah, I think I got the idea of what the RF token is for. The formula, what you just said, really went right through my brain. But I don't know if it's the same RF choke as, what you're thinking of. I'm not exactly sure how to attach this thing because it has it's like a black bar in the middle with, copper wire around it. And then from each side of the black bar are two, just like metal wires. They're, silver, so I guess whatever kind of metal. And I'm not sure, where do I attach that to? Do I attach that to the radiator and one of the radioles, or do I attach that, wrap that, around the radiator? So I'm just not sure about that. And I'll also have to get an SWR meter, which, I'll get sometime soon. So, back to my question. Over to you, Dick.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
I think the application of the 100 microhenry inductor might be a little bit on the heavy side for that application, Dick, only because what I'm thinking is if that has a core and it's got some very, very tightly coupled windings inside, unfortunately, there might be some interwinding capacitance that may detune the antenna. But I'll throw that one back at you and get your opinion on that one. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Very well, Glenn. You brought up an extremely good point. One of the things you're another one of a thousand pieces of information we're going to try to give you all at once, Skyler, is that every RF choke has stamped on it, in theory, how many nanohenries or microhenries or millihenries of inductance. That's a piece of information number one. They also have some particular physical size. They also have some particular method of construction. As far as a formula is concerned, the formula for inductive reactance, knowing the inductor in henries and the frequency and cycles, and you plug it into the formula and you calculate the inductive reactance, that formula would lead you to believe that every inductor you're likely to touch is going to work from DC all the way up through all the RF frequencies and up to light and cosmic rays. Well, that's not real. The bottom line is that every inductor has a particular frequency region over which it works well. Go too low in frequency, where you get too little inductive reactance, you're not getting much action. Every inductor, unless it's extremely unusual in its construction, has some form of self-resonance. Your particular inductor, I'm just going to pick a number out of the air, and I'm going to pass it back to you eventually for you to tell me its physical size, how many inches in diameter and how many inches long. A good RF choke for 2 meters would be approximately a half inch long and a quarter inch in diameter, so to speak, or less. And yours sound like it's considerably larger. Let me drop. Therefore, there's a good possibility that your particular 100 microhenry RF choke runs into self-resonance at 30 megacycles, for instance. And if you use an RF choke higher in frequency, then it runs into self-resonance. It is no longer a choke. It is now a capacitor, even though it says choke on it. What's going on here is that depending on the physical size of the windings and how close they are and what kind of a core they're wound on, there is a given amount of capacitance between all the turns of that so-called RF choke. So even though if you drew a simple schematic diagram of the thing, you would be you'd be drawing a coil on the page with a lead coming out of the top and the bottom of it, if it's a vertically polarized coil, so to speak. In reality, there's a bunch of stray capacitors between those turns, and there's another stray capacitor across the whole DOM coil. As such, the coil will eventually hit parallel resonance, and it's no longer an inductor when it does that. Right at parallel resonance, it has some very useful characteristics if you know what you're doing. Much higher in frequency than the resonance, the self-resonance of the coil of the RF choke, it has very limited use, and in most cases, no use at all. So the fact that you've only spent a dollar and a half or whatever it was on that choke, it's a nice thing to have, but maybe you're not going to be using it. So it may very well, according to what Glenn is saying, and I think I agree with him, it may be beyond the resonant frequency for your particular application, and you probably don't need one in the first place. Just for us to know what it is that you bought. Tell us roughly in diameter and length in inches, what is the physical size of this thing that you bought, Skylar? KC2, WYP, K2RIW in the TechNet, and wait for the beep.
Okay, it's again, it's from Radio Shack, so it's the only RF choke they had, so if you happen to be near the computer, if you want to look it up, there's an actual picture of it there. But it's about 1 1/4 inches long, and the diameter is less than 1/4 inch, but the copper winding is, you know, it's probably wound around at least 30 times. Over to you.
Yeah, I think there's a good chance that that particular coil is not appropriate for 144 megacycles. I'm not going to look at it right now, but a little bit later on I will look at it. What is the part number that I should look for on the Radio Shack website? Over to you, Skylar.
It's 273-0102. Let me go on Radio Shack right now. Hold on. And I'm typing RF choke. Okay, so if you type in RF choke, there's only one that shows up as an actual RF choke. And it, you know, it doesn't look exactly like the one I have. It doesn't show the copper wire wound around it. But it is showing the same catalog number, so I guess it is the same if you want to take a look at that.
Okay, I'm going to look at that a little bit later. And the fact that the one you've got looks different doesn't surprise me, because quite often what Radio Shack does is finds out that somebody has some surplus electronics, they buy a whole lot of them, and even though what they bought this month versus what they bought last month has the exact same name on it, 100 microhenry choke, it could be a different brand name for a different application and so on, and look physically different. And so quite possibly the website, quite often they don't give you enough information, like self-resonant frequency is 50 megacycles, and don't use it beyond that frequency, and it has that number of microhenries of inductance, but you shouldn't exceed this number of amperes of current flowing through it, and so on. So there are a bunch of other numbers you'd like to know. Quite possibly you're not going to be using that, and you don't throw it away. You may very well use that somewhere else later on as we lead you into other experiments, Skylar. Please come back and let us know how this all turns out when somebody eventually loans you a Berg watt meter or some other kind of VISWAR standing wave ratio, voltage standing wave ratio measuring instrumentation. You don't absolutely have to have it. Don't worry about that if you don't. But the scientist in you eventually is going to want you to make a measurement on your antenna to find out whether or not it's a little bit above or a little bit below resonance, and should you be adjusting the length of the radiator. Let me drop.
Yeah, K2KEY.
Go right ahead, Mel. K2KEY.
WCWK.
And WK, you also recognize. Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, a little late, but better late than never, and hopefully I'm doing the right thing, because, you know, after this holiday, 6 hours of toasting and drinking, I think it's caught up to me a little bit. Anyhow, I just got in here, so I want to say good evening to everybody. The one choke that Radio Shack was marketing, and it's the same one I'm thinking of, that was for the CB band, Dick, 27 megahertz, over.
And from the way Skylar described it, I think you've hit the nail on the head, Mel. I think it is an RF choke intended for 27 megacycles. Maybe you could stretch it up to 50 megacycles, the 6 meter ham band, but to use it all the way up at 144 megs, I think is not recommended. The physical size sounds too big. The number of microhenries sounds like it's a lot more than required. And at our higher frequency, I think it could be more troublesome. And I don't think you really need it in the first place. Skylar, to bring you up to speed, has built a ground plane antenna in an SO239. He's built it for 2 meters. And I think he did it with 10-gauge or 12-gauge wire that he bought at a hardware store. And sounds like quite a construction. And you sound normal to us, Mel, and your radio's sounding good tonight. And I'm a little bit amazed that you're saying you were doing that much celebrating. The Mel I know is a bit of a teetotaler. Okay. That's, I'm trying to remember now, who's the next person who signed in tonight? Oh, yes. I know that we're going to have a space report. If I haven't skipped anyone who signed in with questions, you guys are going to let me know right now. Or if you got any strong comments on what's been said up till now, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2MIT is next.
Very good, Jeffrey. You're right on my list, and how in the world did I miss that? You've got the floor, Jeffrey. Wait, make sure you wait for the B. K2, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Beautiful set of call letters. K2RIW in the TechNet.
At my wit's end, you guys tend to not get into product-specific problems, but my amp, before I send it back to ICOM all the way in Washington, I can drive it with 100 watts. The moment I turn on the amp circuit, it's supposed to go, as I adjust the ALC, up to a kilowatt. Adjusting the ALC does nothing. Driving the amp from the radio just even a hair more turns on the protection circuit, the amp stops working, you get what you pay for. You get 80 watts in, you get 80 watts out. I have no idea why I'm doing this. I've replaced every cable and checked it back in, and everything else seems fine, but I'm at my wit's end, and you guys are the smartest guys I know, so maybe I just thought I'd hear an idea from someone who happens to know this configuration. If you don't, just say you don't, and we'll call someone tomorrow who does. Thanks. K2MIT.
Very fine, Jeffrey. I'm going to be passing it back to you in a minute for you to tell us what brand name is your exciter and what brand name is the final amplifier, the afterburner, that you hope you're going to put 100 watts into it and get a kilowatt out of it. And if I understand correctly what you've just told us, all you've been able to do is get up to about 80 watts of input before it goes into some kind of a trip-out function, some kind of a self-protect function, and it sounds like you haven't gotten more than 80 watts out. Doesn't sound like you're getting any gain. Now, there's a number of things that could be going on. Assuming the amplifier is in good working order, and assuming the brand names match, in other words, if you've got a Kenwood amplifier and a Kenwood exciter, under those conditions, you're reasonably sure that the ALC circuits will be compatible. I mean, the word automatic limit control, if I looked at the automatic limit control circuit of ICOM and I looked at the one of Kenwood, if this was the best of all possible worlds, let me drop. You'd like to believe that each one of those major companies, Kenwood, Yaesu, ICOM, Tentec and whatever, all have a universal standard as to what voltage the ALC circuit develops for how many watts of drive. You'd like to believe there was a standard like that, and therefore when the ALC circuit is properly excited, that all the rigs will be incompatible. You can mix brand A of exciter with brand B of amplifier. We'd like to believe that. Now let's get down to the real world. In reality, there's quite a bit of incompatibility between ALC circuits. And the whole purpose of the ALC circuit is that the final amplifier has somewhere a peak detecting circuit. It's looking at peak drive power. It makes a judgment that the peak drive power is more than the proper amount for that afterburner amplifier. It feeds back a control voltage by way of the ALC wire back to the exciter. And the exciter is supposed to crank itself down to a lower amount of gain or a lower amount of power output so as not to exceed that number. That combined with the right kind of audio limiting circuit that's in the single sideband exciter, if that's what you're using, the compatibility of the limiting circuit that gives you speech clipping compatible with the ALC, when that's all playing correctly, it can be kind of beautiful. Let me drop. There's an amazing number of guys out there who never bothered hooking up the ALC at all, and periodically they overdrive the amplifier. And if the amplifier is a little bit conservative in its design, the overdriven cathode circuit usually doesn't damage anything. And the worst that happens is you transmit a little bit of splatter on the air, and the people 10 KC away will start complaining to you that, gee, your signal is awful wide, meaning you're starting to put out square waves and flat tapping and crossover distortion and whatever, intermodulation distortion. That's making your signal wide, and you're taking up more of the band than you should. So there's an awful lot of guys out there using an amplifier without using the ALC at all. So when I pass it back to you, Jeff, don't give up. There's a number of tests you can run to be sure that there's a fix for all of this. What brand name of exciter are you using? What brand name and model number of a final amplifier? And what's the maximum power you have ever seen coming out of that amplifier, and how did you measure it? I mean, are you using just the metering that's in the amplifier, which maybe there's a problem there, or are you using some form of independent metering looking at the real power you've seen coming out of the amplifier? K2MIT, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thanks, Dick. Yeah, it was working yesterday. I've been working for the past 2 years. It's ICOM both sides. ICPW1 is the afterburner, as they call it, and IC7800 is the exciter. I tested it into a dummy load, which has an accurate meter, and I also tested it on the air where no one was looking. Turned it into PSK mode, and I have an external, very nice digital readout watt meter. And the other day I was reading kilowatt when I needed it to. Now it won't go above 100 watts, which, you know, don't know, but ready to hear any tricks you've got up your sleeve or anybody else on the net. Open it up to anybody else if I can do that. I'm not sure if you want to do that, but those are the answers to your questions.
W2TTT.
W2, triple tango recognized. And Gordon, we're going to get over you in a second. But I've got a couple of more questions. Jeff, you've answered the questions very well. You've given us a lot of information. So ICOM 7800 exciter, ICOM PW1 afterburner. You used to see a kilowatt, and now you don't see more than 100 watts. Is there any other clues you can give us? In other words, when the amplifier is in the ready mode, but you're not transmitting into it, by turning the switches on the front panel, most likely you can measure standby current. What is the plate current in the standby mode, in the ready mode, but you're not yet transmitting? What does the current go to when you're transmitting? Is there also metering on the front panel where you can find out how many volts are being fed to the amplifier? Is the power supply still there? So if the tube is alive and well and getting the right amount of bias voltage on its control, right amount of bias voltage on it.
Dick.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, PW1's a solid-state amplifier. It's got four modules that each are multi-transistor in nature.
Oh, boy, am I showing my age. I thought everybody's afterburner had tubes in it. My goodness. I'm being yanked into the 21st century. Okay.
This is why I jumped in, W2TTT. One suggestion, contact Adam Farson, F-A-R-S-O-N. You can look him up on any number of, you just Google Adam Farson. He can help you, number one. Number two, the advice Dick's about to give you applies, but it may be, your mileage may vary because of the solid state nature. You really want to interconnect the exciter to the rig. The rig is matched ALC-wise to that amplifier. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. You want to make sure the control cables are all in place, all that good stuff, before you go forward. And if you really run into a jam, you leave it in my shack for a month. I'll be happy to make sure it all works for you. W2TTT grin.
Eric? Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of those amps, and the drivers die.
Give us a couple more words on that, Eric. When you say the drivers die, in other words, from his exciter, his 7800, there's a driving stage that goes to first the afterburner solid-state amplifier, that in turn drives the four modules. What are the clues to that exciter driving and failure? And what's your guess as to the price of that repair? And what causes it to fail? KE2EJ, take your time. Tell us whatever you know about that amp. K2RIW in the TechNet.
It's K2RIW, KE2EJ. There's a four-way power divider. There's a single transistor driver. I forget. It's a 2SD something. I don't remember what it is. But it opens up. And actually, a couple of power across the open part of the transistor. You still continue to get output, but it's, you know, it should be 1,000 watts. You get about maybe 80, 50, 60, depending upon where the leads are when they blow up.
Hey, interesting. And Gordon, it sounds to me like you've got hands-on experience with this exact amplifier. Tell me about whether or not you've experienced, or any of your friends have experienced, failure of that driver stage. What are the symptoms? What's the usual repair? How extensive and all that? W2, Tango, Tango, Tango. The man who runs the TechNet in New Jersey. K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Gordon. Mel recognized, but Gordon first. And Gordon, wait for the beep and then 1 or 2 seconds.
And somebody double with Mel, too, coming in, too, so you might want to pick him up.
All right.
As far as the comments. Well, I only know a few secondhand stories. I've never sat in front of one myself, but I watch the ICOM list, and I watch the 756 Pro 3 and the 7700 and 7800 lists. That are kicking around, and this is a common problem. You can blow the power divider circuit or the transistors that drive it. All these things do apply. The failure mode, there is no one failure mode, but the best way to make sure that you're not going to get success is to not completely interconnect the amplifier with the radio. I mean, an ICOM rig of 7800 stature with a PW1 is meant to sing and ring together. So there's not a lot of stuff left to your imagination. If you hook it up right and follow the procedures they tell you, it'll be fine. And I'm just curious if everything has been set up right. The other thing I was curious about is, are we sure about the quality of the antenna that this thing's attached to at this point? Are there issues there? And it look okay, but maybe arcing over, therefore causing the amplifier to back off. I mean, that's another variant of the theme, too. Bad antennas, especially after all the weather we've had recently. Back to net, W2TTT.
Yeah, most of the afterburners that I've ever used will have some form of output metering in which you can get a clue as to the forward and reverse power and whether or not the amplifier is going into a reasonably good antenna. I know that we've got Mel and one other person who's going to give us some further comments. I'm going to go to them in that order. Mel, I wonder how much experience the guys at the Kings County Radio Club and you in particular have had with the PW1 ICOM afterburner. K2, K-E-Y, K2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
And Dick, could you add me to the comment list, KC2, QIQ?
You're on it, Glenn. Go ahead, Mel.
This is K2KEY. I used the exact setup one time that he's mentioning. ICOM 7800, excellent, beautiful piece of equipment. And the IC-PW1, Dick. That is the number of the amplifier. And one of the problems that, in fact, just happened, I was discussing, just on the air with it and talking to somebody at the time that was had problems with the ICP W1, and I just asked him. I said, "Well, what was the answer to the problem?" He says, "They serviced it. That this time was actually had problems with it while it was under warranty. Also, tripping out as soon as any drive was applied, it would trip out." And his comment to me was that, in talking to somebody at ICOM at the time, I would like to know one question, and then I'll associate it with it. Are you running the amplifier on 110 or 220? Just answer me that question, over.
You've got it, Jeff.
220, and I also want to verify the other gentleman's comment. Did he say that there was a problem in the amp or a problem in the 7800 driving circuit?
I'm pretty sure we're describing the amp, not the 7800. So he's running it on 220. Back to you, Mel.
Okay. The driving it on, the, running it on the 220. Now, right. The 7800 is easy enough, of course, to put on the air independently. Of course, it's a transceiver, so no problem getting on the air with that, with its 100 watts and getting reports. And of course, looking at the meters, it's fully instrumented. It's one thing about that radio, it does have every kind of indication on the front panel of the 7800 as to all operating conditions. The amplifier also has a very good circuitry built into it. The ALC and everything plugs in directly and is has a very wide range, extremely wide range ALC. Now, the running it at a kilowatt level, they had one of the power trans, one of the alpha transistors, had failed a couple of times on this person. And I don't know. Should I say maybe they recommend, that, well, they list the amplifier as 100% duty cycle at a kilowatt. But if you're running it on packet, or one of those modes where, you know, it's keyed down, I have heard a number of people mentioning failures, Dick, over.
Right on. Okay, so that's a pretty tough mode. All righty, there was a person who said comment, and then Glenn in that order. Who was the person that said comment about four transmissions ago?
That was me, K2MIT. It's been answered.
Very fine. Glenn, KC2QIQ, wait for the beep, and tell us what you know about this setup.
Yeah, actually, I have a question first. Was the failure, well, is this setup first being used in a PSK, FSK, RIDI type of configuration, and has it been operated there any time, and did it possibly fail in this mode or right after this mode?
You got it, Jeff.
Well, the manual is so atrocious that ICOM actually came out with a PowerPoint document that you download in order to connect it tune the two radios together, and it assumes a 7800. Actually, it assumes different radios. And it tells you to go into RTTY mode and drive the amp off, just the tuner, to 100 watts. And then you get this little itty-bitty screwdriver, which is so hard. I just don't know why they don't make it a knob on the back. And then you stop transmitting. You push the amp button on. It says amp protect. And you transmit again, and you adjust the ALC probably about halfway until you got a kilowatt out. And then you're done, and then you use it in USB mode. I don't use RTTY. And that's the way you set up the ALC circuitry. Someone mentioned it's kind of automatic, but this document from ICOM doesn't mention that. Now, when I try to follow the same directions, I turn the ALC all the way, it doesn't make a difference. It stays at 100 watts. If you increase the output of the radio, even just a hair, then it trips. So I'm beginning to suspect that there's something wrong in one of those four transistor outputs that the gentleman before spoke of. Over to you, Dick.
K2KEY, one more comment.
Go ahead, Mel.
I'm not done yet, but give it to Mel first.
Okay, this is K2KEY again. All right, it does not have automatic ALC. That doesn't exist. That is manually adjusted. It does include an automatic antenna tuner. This is, amplifier is meant to be run from 160 to 6 meters. It comes with 10 meters, you know, locked out, but if you present a ham license, what they used to do is give you the modification to include also 10 meters, because I did make that modification. And again, the ALC has to be adjusted over a range, but it does include the automatic antenna tuner. There has been problems with the automatic antenna tuner. Let me tell you, that I have heard consistent problems that the automatic antenna tuner has been one of the sources of failures, and I believe it was traced down in one case or two cases that I know of.